We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime.
Well, thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
Hello, this is Cleta Mitchell, and I'm welcoming you today to this episode of Who's Counting? This is our podcast from the Election Integrity Network of the Conservative Partnership Institute, in which we talk about all things related to elections, how elections are supposed to work, how elections often don't work the way they're supposed to, and what we as citizens can do to reclaim our elections and protect our country from the assaults by the radical left. So today, I am extremely honored to be able to have as my guest someone that I know and that I think you will all be so happy to get to know, and that is Christine Brim. Christine is the current head of, and I don't know what title you have, Christine, so you can correct me, but the Fairfax County, Virginia Election Integrity Organization. This is a group of citizens, and Christine will tell you more about it, but I just must tell you that historically, Fairfax County, Virginia has been a real problem in terms of the way its elections have functioned, and Christine is here today to tell us exactly what they've done in 2021 as citizens, how you can do the same things in your area, and just all the things about what citizens really can do to save our elections. So it's a great honor to be able to welcome you, Christine, and to introduce you to the audience of Who's Counting. So welcome, Christine.
Well, thank you, Cleta, so much. And it's such an honor to be here. And I just want to say this podcast and Who's Counting as a program is so important. It's so timely. And I just hope you find the national audience, and I know you are, that needs to hear this, because it isn't just the information. It's bringing people together. It's giving them the morale building that they really need to take on this sometimes daunting task, and to keep at it and to persist. So let's get as many people together listening to this and sharing information as we can. And I want to do a plug for the Citizens Guide that just went up recently at your website. I finally found time to go through it, and it's just absolutely crucial. It's a checklist in a lot of ways. It's a comprehensive outline of all the different tasks which any group would want to do, and let me say, you won't get it done the first year, but it's a kind of strategic view as well of all the things that you need to do over time. And some of these you'll get, you know, doing regularly every year, and some of them you may just do right before and around an election. But it's a one of a kind document. I've never seen anything like it, and it's really handy. It's only 20 pages. And it is the start of a handbook that any group could do. A little county, a municipality, a huge county like Fairfax. So Fairfax County in Virginia accounts for fully 1/7 of the votes in the state. So when we sneeze, Virginia gets a cold, and we are the bluest of the blue. We weren't always, but we've become that way. We're a bedroom community for the federal government. And so we have gone from sometimes a 60-40 Republican-Democrat county about 20 years ago to now as bad as a 75-25 Democrat majority. And that was very much the situation in 2020, for example. So having said that, we are digging our way out of that hole, as you say, right? We are coming out of there, and it's been a tremendous challenge. We had a lot of help from across the state, and that's important too, to understand that when you start out, you feel like you're alone, but if you're lucky and you have a strong state party, as we did in the Republican Party of Virginia, that really helps. It helps to build at the time of a statewide election too, because that really motivates people. So our governor's race, which the Republicans won with Glenn Youngkin and with Winsome Sears and with Jason Mayorkas, was an amazing catalyzing event. And I think it's probably easier to build when you have that sense of urgency and you know, on some days, desperation, right. to motivate people and to get them, you know, off of wanting to volunteer into that crucial divide where they take action. And so that's a real motivational challenge.
So, Christine, tell everybody a little bit about your background. What did you do before election integrity started to consume your life?
So I have a background in both IT and in business and in the nonprofit sector. I was with the National Security Think Tank for a few years as their chief operating officer. So I'm very much a nuts and bolt logistics consulting business process, IT person. And at the same time, in a couple of those jobs over the years, I got involved in organizing statewide efforts and for statewide legislation and for statewide public education and sometimes even litigation. So that is very useful. I retired in 2013 and then was an election officer and a poll watcher in a couple elections locally. And then after the 2020 election, when so many of us felt that there had been serious challenges and problems, I ended up getting much more involved in trying to build a better infrastructure here in Fairfax. And we had, as a lot of places, you start with maybe 10 or 20 people, but you're aware that there are hundreds and hundreds of people who feel the way that you do. And the challenge is how you connect with them and then how you organize them.
So how did you do that?
Well, we did it haphazardly and badly at first, and then we did it better later. and that's how you do this. You don't necessarily, I mean, if we had had your book, that would have been amazing. So I wish I could jump ahead a year. But we had people who had been active in organizing election officers and poll watchers. But Fairfax, so let me give a little bit of background for your listeners on the dreadfulness that is Virginia voting law. We have a 45-day voting season, actually longer because it extends till the Friday after the Tuesday of the vote.
Now, it hasn't always been this way, right?
Absolutely not. This was in 2020 and 2021. And to some extent, back in the Terry McAuliffe's previous tenure as governor, when he managed to get across both laws and also just some executive guidances and administrative regs, which began this degradation of voting law in Virginia. But we do not have signature matching. We have next year, unless we can change it, we're going to have same day registration. Our voter ID laws, which used to have photo ID as a requirement, no longer do. And in fact, you can come in with no ID and simply sign an affirmation statement and vote in Virginia. We have no excuse absentee voting. We allow third party groups on the hard left, the Center for Voter Information and Voter Participation Group, sent out 2.2 million applications for absentee ballots to people this year. Our own registrar in Fairfax decided to violate the law and to accept those applications without the required Social Security number of final four digits, and on and on and on. I mean, it's a parade of horribles. And we are just so hopeful now that we have not just a Republican governor who is able to bring in new leadership into the Office of Elections, but also who's committed to election integrity in ways that I don't think we've had in this state for, you know, a long, long time. And this is great because this is the time when also the public is focused on this and committed to it in ways that I don't think anyone could have anticipated. The interest and curiosity and ability to willingness to learn about election laws, which are a pretty arcane area of law, And it's complex. It's Byzantine. There's the laws and the regs and the guidances and the executive guidances and the referred. It goes on and on and on.
And then there are the practices that the local registrars have just been doing forever.
Forever. And it's tradition or custom. And they say it's their discretion. And nobody has ever, in some places ever, questioned them. And so this was not just a political movement in many ways. This was a cultural change. This was the idea that we could actually show up and watch things that nobody had tried to watch before. So just to return to the 45-day election season, which really is endless, we had not had in Fairfax, for the large part, any observers, any poll watchers there. And when all that early voting is actually done by employees of the registrar's office, not by election officers. So there is no, in Virginia, there's an effort to get Republican and Democrat and independent, if needed, election officers present on election day. But there is no such requirement for early voting. And that's when in 2020, a third of the voting was early voting. A third was mail-in and roughly a third was on election day. Now, interestingly, for this election in 2021, 65% of the voting was on election day.
25%,
really? 25% was early voting in person, where you go to these. We have 16 satellite offices in Fairfax County. And then the remainder, about 14%, was done with mail-in and Dropbox ballots. An enormous change from 2020.
Why do you think that was?
It's very hard to speculate on that. I think it shows the effects in part of the of COVID and everyone being scared in some ways of showing up on election day, which I think is really regrettable. But I think it also is an anomaly in counting and tracking the votes that deserves further scrutiny. I think that the new normal that everyone was telling us we had to accept, that was at least a third of the ballots, if not more, would all be mail-in, has now been completely contradicted by the 2021 election. And the big push to do 100% mail-in, which I think would be a disaster because the opportunities for fraud are enormous with mail-in ballots. I think that's been pushed back. I think the voters in Virginia of both parties have said, we're not interested in complete mail-in balloting. And we're certainly not, 65% of them showed up on election day. That's not just Republicans. We won, but we didn't win that well. And in Fairfax, we are so blue that as our goal in Fairfax, and this is not something, this is not defeatist, this is just realistic. Our goal is to lose less badly. Right. When in Fairfax, and we would love to win. We want to win. But right now, we're moving towards that. And ultimately, we want to get to 60-40 or, 65-35, where we're the 65. But right now, we're just trying to cut our losses. And we did that. This was 35,000 more people voted Republican in Fairfax this year than did in the last gubernatorial election in 2017. Wow. So the get out the vote effort, as well as the poll watcher effort, was significant. And you're asking, how do we recruit? And I think that's important.
Let's do this. Before we go to the recruiting of the poll watchers, I'd be interested. I think it would be important to share with people, you weren't just doing poll watching.
Oh, no.
So why don't you take a step back and talk about how you first came together, with whom, and the sort of how it evolved and the different tasks that people were engaged in throughout 2021.
And it really starts with a small group, as almost everything does, of three or four people. And then they reach out, and soon you're maybe 10 or 20. And we wanted, excuse me one second, we wanted very much to develop the kinds of capabilities that we knew we would need. So we needed a lawyer or two, And so we set up a legal group. And eventually we had five or six lawyers, not necessarily in the Virginia bar, but people who were beginning to read the election law, look at some of the decisions that had come through, beginning to be prepared to answer questions on that. We also pulled together an IT team of data analysts because we wanted to get the voter registration and voter history data for Fairfax County from the 2020 election. So we could begin to understand just the demographics and the nature of who had voted, and also be able to look for potential problems in the voter rolls. Voter list maintenance is a huge task. It's ongoing. It's one of the biggest problems across the country. Virginia is not unique in having problems with that. And it is just going to be an ongoing fight. But we hope that we can get that, make some progress in that, not only under our current governor, our future governor, Governor Youngkin, but I think in red states, we're seeing a lot more progress in that as well. Some of this needs to be dealt with at the federal level as well to help people clean up their lists. But that was a big focus. So we got a couple of data guys. We managed to get the data housed appropriately where it was safe and secure. We have business processes. So in elections, you have all kinds of activities that involve basically the entire election process, including where the ballots are, the new ballots, ordering the ballots, getting the ballots mailed if they're absentee ballots, getting the ballots if it's election day or early voting from the storage place out to where the polling place is. Think of it as a constant logistics exercise of some complexity, and the chain of custody of all of those election materials at every step is something that you want to have visibility into if you possibly can. A lot of election offices do not want to grant you that visibility. They only will interpret your role as an authorized observer to be there on election day, or maybe if you're lucky on early voting. But what we wanted to do and continue and encourage everybody to do is to expand that so that you get documentation and if possible, observers for every time something crucial to the election integrity is moved from point A to point B. And if they are logging this, if possible, you want copies of those logs. Now, we're being denied a number of those logs right now by our general registrar in Fairfax. And so those kinds of issues, and there were a lot of issues that came up as well from our poll watchers, are the exactly what we anticipated. We were trying to understand them in the abstract when we got started. Now we have an election worth of experience with over 700 poll watchers that were out there observing. And we're pulling in all of those reports and beginning to develop them into really a set of I want to say rules of engagement. It's the closest I can get, where instead of our individual observers having to negotiate one-on-one what they're allowed to do, we can get this much more clarified before we start our next election in 2022. But it's a very evolutionary process. I mean, we had a legal group, we had a process group, we had a data group. You have people looking at election results because, of course, that's, you know, we were looking at what was reported from 2020. Many states will have a change log in election results as well, which shows each time someone changes what's in the what's uploaded for election results, there will be a change issued on a database. Virginia's, I think, particularly good about putting some of this up there. And we have a particularly good Freedom of Information Act law. So we have strengths and weaknesses here.
I agree with you, Christine, that you do, that Virginia's FOIA law is very citizen user friendly and limited exceptions, and you don't have to have some formal mechanism, and they have to answer in 5 days.
Right. They can get a week's extension, but beyond that, no, they can't. I mean, then they have to give you something. And I think the FOIA office in Fairfax is absolutely terrific. We get turned down a lot, but that's because of the decisions of the Office of Elections. And but the FOIA office has been just great. They do everything they can to at least educate us. I think to pull back just a little bit, we kind of, what you'll find if you're trying to organize this is to begin with, you have almost a kind of dizziness because the sheer breadth of what you're trying to do seems so overwhelming. You have information overload. I mean, it's one thing to say, know your election laws. It's another thing to look at the 400-page book or and the regulations and say, how do I even get started? And I mean, I think much of this is also, we almost need a workbook beyond the guidebook, which kind of goes, here's what your first week looks like. You know, here's a realistic way in a year to begin building step by step, because by breaking this into baby steps, it becomes feasible. And so you're constantly going back and forth between, you know, this sense of also that everybody else knows far more than you do, that you're dealing with in the Office of Elections and in the state. And the reason is that they do. I mean, this is what they do for a living. You're coming in as a citizen volunteer. You're scrambling to learn everything you can. And you will be in learning mode and information gathering mode and sort of trying to just organize it all to begin with for a while. We were envious to such a huge extent of those states that did not have an election in 2021, because we had to try and understand what had happened in 2020, looking at data, comparing our voter registration files to the national change of address files, seeing who had moved in 2019 but was still in the on the voter rolls, you know, all of this, looking at, to the extent we could, lists of felons who should have been removed. And we didn't, we only found a couple. I mean, they were, by and large, the lists had been cleaned for, from what we could tell, for people who had committed felonies and who had not been cleared, because we have an extensive process of also restoring rights in Virginia to people. But the roles were particularly, list maintenance had simply not been done in Virginia in the summer to a large extent of 2020. Normally they would have exchanged data with other states to see who had moved. They didn't do that. Normally they would have done the national change of address purges of the, or, you know, deletions of the voters who had clearly moved. They didn't do that. And the excuse that they gave was COVID, which is nuts.
Right. COVID is the excuse for everything, isn't it?
So we went into 2020 in Virginia with poorly maintained, at best, voter lists. And then in December, after the election, that's when they sent out the mailing that they should have done earlier, and then took, I don't know, 40,000 people, some large number of thousands of people off the voter rolls. But it was after the election. So this is extraordinarily bad behavior. We came into the process, of course, after that. We didn't even get started as an organization till around March. And, you know, and there was a slow gear up process. We did make a couple good decisions, I think, which was, besides trying to find key people in certain areas and assign them some tasks, we did use a collaboration system called Basecamp, which let us at least have a place where we could contact people, do side conversations, make announcements, schedule meetings, and probably most importantly, have a document repository. So that everybody could look at this. And there are probably 50 other competing products out there. So I'm not an advocate of one or the other. I just, again, and I think the important thing is just get started. Just get started. If what you do is a personal email list, do that. You know, if you want to do a Google Sheet or a Google site or a Google group and store documents there and use a schedule, fantastic, do that. I think We did create a Zoom account just for our group, Fairfax Election Integrity. I would do that right away. We sort of just threw up infrastructure as fast as we needed it, because we would go, oh, we need a meeting. Okay, let's go get a Zoom account. And everything felt very much like it was being improvised as fast as it could be. Because we didn't have this wonderful citizen's guide to building election integrity infrastructure in our hands. But you know what? There is no wrong way to do this, is the other thing. If you make
really
a mistake,
there's no
just
wrong
fix
way.
It.
Just do it.
Just do it.
Do it.
Fix it. We used to say doing it ugly is better than not doing it at all. And I think that the more that you can feel that you're able to do your own lessons learned activities. So if you need to pivot fast and change what you're doing, you can. That will be good. That will be an important part of what you're doing. I do think that there's a need for some things to be state level and some things to be county or municipality level. So the more that our states can understand what is in their bailiwick for supporting election integrity, the better. Because some of these things are legislation that needs to be done at the state level. There are guidances that come from the Office of Elections. Much of the NVRA, the National Voter Registration Act, is federal, right? So some of the laws that limit what we can do or that enable us to do things are federal. You never think you're going to have to become an expert in election law, and we're not. So that's the other thing, is understanding you're going to have to kind of get going, and you won't be 100% on anything, but you've got to do your best. But there are things you can do right away. You can go down, at least in Virginia, and I think this is any state, and you can look at the voter registration applications. You can inspect them. You can write down that information. You can see, if they left off fields. In Virginia, you can go and inspect and take notes of applications for absentee ballots, which was how we were able to find out that over 500 of these applications had been accepted by our registrar without the mandatory, legally required Social Security number. Which meant that there was, and of course, remember, in Virginia, we don't have signature matching. So there really was no way then to identify that individual was who they said they were.
So, and one of the things that we learned, and I think you mentioned, that you had these third party groups that were funded by left-wing donors, and they were sending out to people on the voter rolls applications for absentee ballots that were pre-populated with information other than that one provision, the requirement that you're supposed, the voter himself or herself is supposed to put the last four digits of his or her Social Security number on the application before sending it in. And that's really the only identifying information.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's nothing. And so if these go out to a house, now they send in that application and then they're sent the absentee ballot. But you could end up with someone, in theory, right? We're doing all kinds of what they call canvassing, where we're looking at addresses where we have, my favorite is about a 1,200 square foot house that has 16 registered voters in it. That's a packed house. We've got, and maybe it's legit, I don't know, but we have a lot of questionable, particularly people who have moved. Where they're still on the Virginia rolls. They should be removed from the Virginia rolls. We also have a very, very inadequate process in Virginia, and I think nationwide, for helping remove people who are not citizens, who are nonetheless on the voter registration rolls. And in Virginia, the law is very biased, and this was done largely under the governorship of Terry McAuliffe, who was a governor previously, a Democrat. But there's a very little is required on a voter registration application. No Social Security number is required on a voter registration application. It's pretty devastating. And so I think that the people who work for the state probably do the best they can, but it's the laws in Virginia that are lawless. And it's as if you had the entire system run in such a way as to be the exact opposite of election integrity.
So I'm wondering if, I suppose that I know that the motor voter law, NVRA, requires that people have to be given the opportunity to register to vote when they get a driver's license, when they apply for social services. I'm wondering if the state, and I don't know this off the top of my head, this is a Christian Adams question, whether or not the state could require that the last four digits of the Social Security number be included in that voter registration so that when it goes to the election office, then that's input with the voter on the voter rolls.
So. Well, that would be great. As it is, the voter, the DMV says that they strip off anything dealing with election information when it goes to the electoral office. So they have no information about what was actually sent. And then the election office says, well, I'm sorry, that's personal proprietary information. But you can go down to the office of your local registrar and look at the applications. So to the extent that it's coming in that way, there is some visibility into it. And so we're hopefully going to start doing that in a much more concerted way. There are lots of small tasks that can be done on literally a weekly basis by volunteers, in addition to these larger election-oriented tasks where you get, you know, this whole list of everybody that voted, and then you run it against the national change of address information. You try to get a sense of, you know, who might have voted and who shouldn't be qualified to be on the list. But it is a real problem. You do not need an address in Virginia to register to vote, because we support the idea of people who are homeless voting, registering. But as a result, it isn't that you go to a homeless shelter and use their address, which would be at least something. You literally just need to be able to be located in a precinct. So if you say, here's my address, I'm in the park bench two streets down from the 7-Eleven, and they can say, aha, that's, you know, the Waples Mill precinct, you're good to go. That's all you need. You do not need a phone number. You do not need. So when we talk about the Office of Elections sending out a mailing to people, right, which then will bounce back to show that they're no longer registered there, the problem is that we don't actually require people to have mailing addresses. There's the travesty that is voter registration requirements in Virginia is, I can't imagine that it's not, you know, among the worst in this country. And of course, remember, no signature matching for the voter of any kind ever under any document anywhere. So you can just do a scrawl. It doesn't matter.
Go ahead.
No, I'm.
Well, you know, one of the things that that I worry about is that these provisions that the left pressures the office holders, legislatures to adopt, and that had been adopted in Virginia, that are supposed to be to protect the right to vote of the homeless person or whatever, it really has the opposite impact. Those are the most vulnerable voters.
Absolutely.
And I've thought, you know, well, I've thought a lot about what could be done to try to protect them from political operatives, because I've seen this going on for years where you have operatives who will bring people from a group home, say you have people who are either mentally disabled or physically disabled, and they live in a group home, and they get brought in to a polling place, and this person who's basically goes in and casts their ballot for them. Same thing with elderly, same thing with homeless. And so I'm wondering if we shouldn't have some, as you know, one of the chapters, one of the checklists is protecting vulnerable voters in the Citizen's Guide. And I've really thought that the statutes ought to say that if you don't have a permanent address, that that you could come in and register at the register and vote in the presence of a voting official, whether it's early voting or election day, but you can register there, and at least that would have some protection.
It would. And I think that's also a great argument for helping people get photo IDs and for making photo IDs mandatory. If I'm a person who's homeless, one of the best things that could happen for me would be to have a photo ID so that I have that legitimacy. And I can go places, I can buy things, I can be recognized. And over 80% of the American public in poll after poll after poll supports photo ID for voters. And but I think vulnerable voters are a particular group that need that. And I'm getting up in years. At some point, I'm going to be in that nursing home, and I want to be able to vote. And we have some very politically active people in assisted living and in a wide range of caring situations. And we want them to vote. We want them to, but we want them to do it the way that they want to vote. We want to respect them and give them the dignity and the autonomy of it being their vote, not somebody else's vote.
And in fact, one of the things that has been discovered in Wisconsin, and I know this is something going on everywhere, is that there were staff people in nursing homes who essentially just sent in for an absentee ballot and got a ballot and voted that ballot in the name of elderly people in Wisconsin. That in one case, the way this first investigation began in Racine, Wisconsin, is that a woman looked and her mother, who's had dementia for 10 years and had died in October of 2020, shows up as having voted in 2020. And and she called the DA's office and said, something's amiss here. And when the sheriff's office conducted a 10-month investigation into nursing homes in Racine County, found that's exactly what happened. And the state election office had waived the statute that's on the books to keep that very thing from happening. That's where we have to have the citizens' engagement to stop the things that are, when the legislature writes a law to protect people. I mean, you're talking about all the ways the legislature in Virginia has upended integrity. But when you have a statute on the books to protect the integrity of the election, and then you have unelected bureaucrats or commissioners or administrators that just say, well, that pesky little law, you don't really need to follow that.
Well, we have complete noncompliance by general registrars, and particularly in Fairfax, we had instances of that. Because they decide it's up to their discretion which laws they're going to enforce and which they won't. But we also have the problem that when someone is identified as having voted twice, for example, or trying to vote twice, being illegally registered, we don't enforce any penalties. That's been reported for years out of Fairfax and out of other counties and cities in Virginia. It goes up and they get a pass. So if you know you're never going to have the law enforced, or if you know your general registrar is not even going to try to comply with the law, it's pretty much a lawless situation. And this is why we have a real need for this new governor and hopefully our new legislature to begin getting a grip on this.
Well, you know, one of the things that I learned from your lawsuit, Christine, I mean, and I'd like you to talk about that. Well, why don't you talk about how you learned about the fact that your registrar was not enforcing the law, and then what happened?
Well, one of the, as we got a little bit bigger and we were, you know, now maybe 30 functioning, you know, working groups, or 30 people were in different working groups, and we were gradually beginning to get some results from our Freedom of Information Act requests, and we kind of had the data, and you're sort of getting there. One of the things, we were beginning to spend a lot more time down at the Office of Elections. And we also had people who got to know us. And so we were alerted that the registrar, September 23rd, I believe it was, right after early voting had started on September 17th, had decreed that absentee ballot applications did not need to have the legally required final four digits, the Social Security number. And as we've discussed, you know, there's no signature matching, and therefore that literally was the only thing that was required. So I went down and requested to see all of the applications, because under our law here in Virginia, and I don't know if this is the case everywhere, but we can inspect them. We can't take photos of them, but we were allowed to inspect all these applications. So what I did was, we had a list of who had applied, and we just went in, and one after another volunteer and I went. And we just checked them off. And now at this point, we have over 500 of the applications which have been accepted. And the staff, quite frankly, were concerned. It was the general registrar who had made this decision somewhat prim. And he decided that it was that he could, on his own discretion, determine that that voter was qualified to vote. And he did not have to follow the law requiring the final four.
Was he requiring any other research or anything, or just accepting it without the four digits and just going on?
The 99% of these that we saw had come from these two left-wing groups that pre-populated the name and the address information in there off of our voter rolls, right? So on the basis of the fact that these were pre-populated and typed, and that it was based on data that they had gotten by purchasing it from the state of Virginia, he decreed that therefore, by definition, it was acceptable. And because we don't do signature matching, and you know, there was no way you could say that it wasn't acceptable at that point. But almost every single one was from the Voter Participation Center or the Center for Voter Information. On the bottom of it, it had the initials for the two groups that had issued it. So we kept a record of that too. So we did. J. Christian Adams from the Public Interest Law Foundation filed a lawsuit. Based on an argument from the Virginia Constitution, the state constitution, and I simply prepared a short affidavit attesting to what I had seen, just the facts. And that lawsuit did go to court, and unfortunately it was dismissed because of a lack of standing. And now those particular 500 applications are moot. Because, you know, not only have those people submitted their absentee ballots if they chose to, but the election's been certified and so on. So we're now moving on. However, if he tries to do this again next year, I think we'll be in a stronger position. We certainly have the detailed list of everybody whom he approved without a Social Security number for 2021. If he tries to do it again in 2022, we then have a pattern, and we hope we can get a guidance from the new commissioner of elections under the new governor that will say, no, you got to comply with the law. You know, you can't just decide, I'll comply with the ones in column B, but I don't like the ones in column A, so I'm going to let those slide. And again, this isn't so much a numbers game. 500 is not a huge number. It's not a small number either. It's the precedent set that at this point, if you do an application for absentee ballot on paper, there is nothing required to show that the person who actually is the voter filled it out. You eliminate that final four, you're done.
Well, you know, the other thing too is that I think about everything that we went through in 2020 and literally for 2 years with all of the left-wing organizations all over the country filing lawsuits. And I kept thinking when the judge in Fairfax County said, well, I don't think a citizens group has standing to enforce the law. So it needs to be a candidate. And so he dismissed it for lack of standing and said, you know, I might be wrong, but, and I think he was wrong. But what I think, one of the things that I've realized, and I'm going to say to legislators all over the country, is you need to, once you've enacted, when you're working on enacting an election law, then you need to have in it provisions about giving standing to registered voters to be able to come in and to enforce the law and to uphold the law that the legislature has written against arbitrary dismissal by an election official, an unelected bureaucrat or a commission or a registrar. And I think it should be much tougher on the conversely for a group of citizens to come in to try to invalidate the law, and that they have to be, they ought to, right now it's just the opposite. It's like anybody can come in and try to challenge a duly enacted legislative decision about how an election was to be conducted. But if you're a citizen and you're trying to come in and say, no, we think the legislature wrote this and we think they need to be, that the legislature needs to be the last word, not the judiciary and not some citizens group and not some election administrator. So I really think that's going to be, Christine, thanks to you and your work and that of your volunteers, it's made me really stop and think, and I'm going to become, that's going to be one of the things I'm going to focus on in 2022 with legislators all across the country and write in procedures for judicial review, for standing, for enforcement, because those things are just kind of left to chance. Because who would have thought that you would have all these election officials and judges who would just thumb their nose at what the legislature had done?
And until you have, I think that's great. I mean, I think that would make all the difference in the world in state after state. It certainly would be tremendously helpful in Virginia. And I think finally that we might actually have an environment where that would also happen in Virginia. And we have a lot of laws that need to be either revised or completely replaced, but also that need to be enforced, right? That need to have enforcement mechanisms, and people need to have standing. I think that there's a broader movement or phenomenon rather that this is part of, which is election integrity has mobilized so many people across this country that they're now suddenly looking at their elections that they just took for granted before. And as a result, they're suddenly saying, and they're told repeatedly by the bureaucrats or by, you know, whoever, the state legislators in some cases, their electoral boards, you don't have standing. You have no right to do this. You can't be a poll watcher. Or if you're a poll watcher, you can't look at this. Or no, you can't stand over there. Or no, you can't have that information. And strengthening our FOIA laws, our Freedom of Information Act laws,
yes, that's a good point.
State after state would be huge. And here's
a good point.
Here's one of the, I mean, I sometimes think that's all that I want to do is just go out and work on Freedom of Information Act laws. Because for citizens, that is your first tool. That is that and just showing up and getting started. But Freedom of Information Act laws are crucial. And the more that we can strengthen those, the better. One of the things that we see happening also with elections in particular, but I think we're seeing it elsewhere in governance as well, is in broader areas, is the increasing computerization and networking and so on of all of the election process. So for example, in the past, prior years, the poll pads, the ones that the equipment that shows who's on the voter rolls, just were connected at the local election place. This year, they were networked across the whole county. Well, every time that we automate and we computerize and we network, that information then becomes absolutely forbidden to citizens because rationalization of security and computer security, and I understand that, it's no longer permitted for them to know anything about it. So the more that we automate, the more we work against any kind of transparency or any kind of citizen visibility into the workings of government. And cybersecurity is not an adequate excuse for destroying transparency on elections.
So can you break that down a little bit more? Explain what kind of transparency are you talking about that exist that because of the technology, they now does not exist?
So for example, we have optical scanners that you put your ballot through after you've completed it. We have poll pads, which have the list of the voters on them. And every state's going to have some equivalent to this, right, unless you're doing hand counting for everything. And those are increasingly computerized and they're networked so that, for instance, if somebody votes in one location, it's immediately updated so they can't also vote in half an hour driving across the county in another location. Tabulation is all, of course, automated. And every aspect of that requires cybersecurity. We want it to have cybersecurity. But at the same time, we're running into situations, at least in Fairfax, where chain of custody logs showing, for example, chain of custody of what absentee ballots that were put in drop boxes. They did logs. A lot of this is logs, system logs, chain of custody logs, looking at serial numbers that are on thumb drives that come out of the optical scanners. All of this materiel that's associated with an election, we want to be able to see technical logs, and we also want to see, you know, when it went from point A and was checked in over at point B. And a good deal of this is being denied to us in Fairfax in response to FOIA requests under the justification of security. And so one of the things we're working on is going through all the issues that we know of and looking at standards for election audits from an IT perspective, from an information technology and cybersecurity perspective, and developing a document really detailing what should be done. If they don't want to show it to ordinary citizens, that's fine. Let's bring in an independent auditing group and have them take a look at it and do a report.
Well, although I'm a very big believer that I think your first instinct is right, Christine, which is there should not be, we should not create systems that are beyond the purview of citizens to both understand. One of the things that worries me about the technology, the voting technology and systems, is that the more complicated it gets, as with any technology, the more difficult it is for the layman, the citizen on the election board, electoral board, or the registrar, or the citizen observers to understand. And to me, that's just a recipe for bad things to happen when there are only people who understand it.
And much of what's being kept from citizens isn't a question of cybersecurity, including issues in cybersecurity. We just had a study come out in September of this year for the state agency, in which they pointed out that for the IT department, they are monitoring themselves. They don't have an external group looking at them. They do their own internal evaluation of their own internal projects, and that's it. And they are drastically understaffed in cybersecurity. So to the extent that we are riding on top of that state agency for our voter registration rolls, the VERIS system, we're not in the most secure environment. Sometimes these statements of, oh, we can't tell you anything because, you know, then we would, you know, because it's classified, also hide major omissions on their part in processes, in technology, and in security procedures they should be following. And, you know, citizens need to be able to at least see what they're doing that is immediately relevant to where stuff is going, like where the ballot's stored. You know, what are you doing with those thumb drives? And we had huge issues this year in Fairfax. They had to rescan multiple locations of ballots. The Mount Vernon early voting location, they had to rescan twice because they literally just couldn't keep track of what was on which thumb drive. It was, and so, you know, I am not impressed, let's say, with their authority when it comes to managing IT.
Well, and I do think that it doesn't make any sense to me to say we can't show you chain of custody logs, or we can't show you the evidence of that we did things correctly.
That's exactly
that doesn't make any sense to me. But I do think that there is a great amount of concern among millions of Americans about voting systems and the technology, and the only way to restore that confidence in the voting systems is if people understand how it works, what it's supposed to do, and then have some way after the election to confirm that it happened the way it was supposed to. It's just
absolutely we should have forensic audits, IT audits, business process audits. These should just be a natural, regular part of any election. You do the election, and then you check your work.
And you don't check it yourself.
Right, and you don't check it yourself.
You have someone else check your work.
Absolutely. That's our problem with the state of Virginia right now. And they're trying to.
Oh, it's true in every state. Oh, my gosh. But you know what? It's really, this whole last 12 months has been quite an eye-opening experience, because things that we've taken for granted with elections, you know, my whole life have been upended, and probably for the better, because now we're finding out about how things have been evolving, and now we have to try to get it back. So Christine, tell what you are doing. What is your group doing now? I know you've been having some after action meetings.
We have. So we had over 700 people who volunteered in one shift, possibly many of them several shifts across our lengthy election season here. And we're a very large county. We had about 465,000 people vote. And we have 247 precincts. So that's a lot. We've reached out to all of those. Those are our poll watchers. We're also reaching out to almost 800 election officers. We're working closely with them to get their lessons that they lessons learned, right? They all did reporting on a daily basis. So we were getting in a huge amount of information. As one of our lessons learned is we need several more layers of people just to read the reports as they come in. We're pulling all that together now to really help define rules of engagement and to define areas where we absolutely have multiple people pointing out issues with the county's election processes, with what they were allowing poll watchers to observe, with how they treated voters. Because we had some significant problems with voters and masks this year, and we had problems with a new kind of ballot that was introduced that voters had problems with. We don't have in our county any election office person dedicated to public education. So voters, when they do changes in our county, there's little or no effort to prepare voters for what they're going to encounter. We hope that there are lessons learned on the side of the Office of Elections. There certainly were a lot on our side. There's so many things we would do differently.
Tell everybody sort of what would be your top three things that you would say to people based on this year of experience that you've had? Somebody's listening, somebody wants to start something. What are the top three things you would say you simply must do this? And then maybe what are the top three things you'd say, based on our experience, don't do this?
Well, I think hard question, but definitely improving communications from a technical point of view so that you can get back to people, you can respond to people that are reaching out to you, because and therefore staffing for that. We had three people doing that during the election season. We probably needed more like 10. And so I think a lot of this is just realizing how much you're going to need people to deal with a day-to-day crisis. It's like going to war. You know, you really need like the equivalent of an officer corps. You can't just have three people scheduling and hoping that that's going to handle it. In terms of the election integrity working group effort, I think if we had to do it over again, we would have probably been much more aware of how much we had to learn. In other words, give yourself a month to just sit down and study and share information. And I would love to see your organization, Cleta, actually turn your book into a course. Because we need something that will help people. And of course, every state is different. So this is the problem. Right. We need an infrastructure that kind of lets people put in their state specific modules or even their county specific modules. But the law is typically at a state level.
That's right.
But we need a course so that, because this is a 12 session course to get going on this stuff.
It
really is. And recognizing that is important, because when you get started, people's expectations are very high. And I think that's the other thing, is to manage expectations of your various stakeholders, because there's going to be a lot of expectation. For example, in the beginning of 2021 was sort of like, well, what have you found and how are you going to turn around the 2020 election? And we would have to say, look, we're volunteers. We're just starting. We're just learning. You know, this is a long haul. This is a marathon. We will do everything we can on 2020, but we also had an election in 2021. We have another one in 2022. You're building infrastructure, you're building capacity. And think in terms, not just of the next campaign, think in terms of generations. You're turning around the culture of what citizens do with elections to be more than just poll watchers or election officers or voters or people working in a campaign or get out the vote. You're expanding it into this whole new area of reporting and observing and really becoming an ongoing forensic operation. And it takes a year at least just to figure out what you should have been FOIAing, you know, a year ago, right? Because those records, it takes a long time to dig this stuff out. And that's okay. So I think one of the most important things I would say is accept the fact that you're not going to do it perfectly. Just keep going. You'll get better at it. Don't expect the first year to be great. You'll be so much smarter the second year. We're going into 2022 just in an amazing position compared to where we were at the end of 2020, because we've learned so much. And let me say, it's also due to groups like yours who and others like the Virginia Policy Institute that was the plaintiff on the Social Security number lawsuit, and many others national and certainly across Virginia. And so many groups have come up across the last year, volunteer citizen groups, not necessarily associated with the party, just self-forming. It's like Alexis de Tocqueville, you know, Americans join together when they have a reason to do it, and they get to work. And there are amazing groups that have just keep on sprouting and doing work. Join one of them, find one of them, start one of them. That's the most important thing you can do, and learn and share information, because silos of information don't work. Every piece of information gains in value when it's shared. When you hoard it, it loses value. When you share it, the return on that is enormous. So I think that's why group things like this Citizens Guide are so important, because it really encapsulates so many lessons that I know what went into it to some extent. Clearly, a lot of people contributed their knowledge to that.
Well, Christine, I could not possibly have said any of that any better. That is, I'm going to make sure that we take that segment of what you just said and we make it a standalone, because it is exactly the message that millions of Americans need to hear. So from the bottom of my heart, I want to thank you. I want to thank all your volunteers in Fairfax County and elsewhere. You're a true patriot, and I think it's people like you who are going to save our country. So thank you so much for joining with me, and thank you for being my guest on Who's Counting. And I hope that you will keep me posted and let me know how CPI and our Election Integrity Network can help you, because we're all in this together. So thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Who's Counting. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Help us grow this show by sharing this episode with a friend, and be sure to subscribe and to give us a good review. We need your word of mouth, because big tech can't be trusted and tries to cancel us daily. Help fight back by visiting whoscounting.us and sign up for this podcast, for our newsletter, become part of the Election Integrity Network.